Hello and welcome to Global Research Unlocked, where we discuss what's rising from growth industries to rising risks and opportunities in global markets. I'm TJ Thornton, Head of Product Marketing at BofA Global Research, and we're recording this episode on Monday, April 29th, 2024.
If rates are falling because the job market's very weak and there's a lot of forced sellers, I think we would see potential risk to home prices. If rates are declining because inflation is coming down, but the employment backdrop is still healthy, we do think you would see more supply. Lower rates are going to increase supply just because of that lock-in effect gets reduced. But we also would expect a lot of incremental demand created by improving affordability for current renters.
Interest rates, insurance costs, utility bills, all these have been rising over the last couple of years, yet new home sales, at least, have remained remarkably resilient. Today, we're talking with Rafe Jadrosich, who covers U.S. home building and building products companies at BofA Global Research. We'll discuss the housing outlook from here, whether lower rates might actually challenge the prognosis for new home sales, and whether this well-trodden story of house price strength in the Sun Belt is set to continue, or if there's a new region that's looking even brighter, even though it may be cloudier, especially in winter. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, TJ. It's great to be joining you at another fascinating time for the housing market.
Yes, indeed. All right, so let's start with the critical question of rates. Since the end of 2021, the 30-year mortgage rate has gone from around 2% to above 6%. Yet new single-family home sales are down only marginally from late 2021 levels. Why do you think sales have held up despite this major affordability headwind in the form of higher rates?
Great question, TJ. I think the simple answer is there is a shortage of homes in the places where people want to live. If you look at the U.S. Census Bureau data for migration, there's about 1,000 people a day that move to Florida, 1,000 people a day that move to Texas, and we're not building that many homes. If you look at vacancy rates across the country, they're near all-time lows. You have two dual demographic tailwinds. First, for millennials entering the peak home buying age. And then you also have a lot of wealthy boomers that are still in the market. And boomers are actually the largest buyers in the market today. In terms of addressing affordability, home builders have been able to adjust their inventory. Simply put, they can just build smaller homes. And then they also have different tools they can pull from. They can offer mortgage rate buydowns and other incentives to help buyers get to a specific monthly payment that they're targeting.
Rick, just a quick follow-up on that question about millennials, because we've been talking about that for so long. How much longer does it last to where we get past this peak of millennial home buying and maybe the demand environment isn't quite as strong?
Millennials took a little bit longer to enter the housing market compared to prior generations. If you look historically, when people are in their late 20s, the home ownership rate is around 30% in the US. By the time the average person hits the mid 30s, that rate has historically jumped to around 60%. That transition from late 20s to mid 30s is a period when a lot of people buy homes. And that's exactly where we are for millennials right now. The median millennials, 33, 34 years old. We expect this tailwind to last for another half decade or so. As we get to 2029, 2030, that's when we start to see this tail off.
Got it. And there is this disconnect between strength in new home sales and weakness in terms of existing home sales. Existing home sales are down substantially since late 2021, which is when rates really started to rise. Why the disconnect between the two?
To your point, we are tracking near the lowest level of existing home sales since 1995. And a lot of that is just driven by the inventory that's available. 40% of homes in the US do not have a mortgage. Out of the remaining 60%, 80% of those are locked in below 5%, with the average mortgage rate around 3.5%. But with mortgage rates pushing above 7% today, the disincentive to sell is very high for current homeowners. So that has kept the inventory very tight. Just to put it in context of the new home market, if you look at the available inventory in the housing market, so that's the combined listings for both new homes from home builders and then the existing resale market, new homes are 40% of the available listings compared to a historical average of around 15%. There's just not a lot of existing homes for sale, and the ones that are out there are very expensive. The affordability is a lot more challenged in the existing home market compared to the new home market.
If interest rates were to fall, that would improve housing affordability, which all else equal would seem to be a positive for new home sales. However, you'd also have less of this lock-in effect, and presumably a lot of existing home inventory would get freed up. How do you think about that and the impact that it could have on new home sales if there are suddenly a bunch of existing homes that are now hitting the market?
It's a really good question because we've been in this unique time where new home demand has stayed robust, even though rates have gone higher. So what does that mean when rates come lower? I think some of this depends on why rates are falling. If rates are falling because the job market's very weak and there's a lot of forced sellers, I think we would see potential risk to home prices. If rates are declining because inflation is coming down, but the employment backdrop is still healthy, we do think you would see more supply. Lower rates are going to increase supply just because of that lock-in effect gets reduced. But we also would expect a lot of incremental demand created by improving affordability for current renters. Just to think about some quantification of this, there's over 3 million renters today that make over $150,000 a year. That's a lot of potential demand that's on the sideline that will also come in. The National Association of Home Builders estimates that for every 25 basis points of mortgage rate decline from around 7% where mortgage rates are today, you're pricing in about 1 million households. We would definitely expect the resale inventory to pick up from current levels, but whatever amount of inventory that comes on the market, we would expect at least that amount of demand to come on. And then I also think it's worth pointing out, even if resale listings rise, the sellers often become buyers. You still need a place to live ultimately. And a lot of times those buyers are coming in with a lot of cash. So I think part of this just depends on why rates are moving lower. But in a soft landing scenario, we would expect enough demand to offset the incremental supply.
And you mentioned before how existing home sales or existing homes are expensive. What is the typical price difference between a new home and an existing home on a square foot basis? And do buyers overwhelmingly prefer new homes? There are some advantages to existing homes that new homes may not have. A more established neighborhood might have more mature trees, more proximity to services, as those homes were built before the sprawl.
Very interesting point on the spread between new and existing homes, because we really are at unprecedented levels. If you don't adjust for square footage, new home prices today are just 5% above existing home prices compared to a historical spread of around 20%. Now, a lot of that has to do with we're now building smaller homes to adjust for the affordability pressure. If I look at it on a per unit basis or adjust for square footage, new home prices are probably down 10 to 15% from the peak, while existing home prices basically have held strong. We're seeing this gap between new and existing home prices narrow. On a square footage basis, though, it's been pretty consistent at around 20%. You outlined a lot of the advantages to the existing home market, and the biggest is location. Dallas is the largest home building market in the U.S. It's been a really rapid growth market over the last couple of decades. The next round of land development in Dallas-Fort Worth metro area is going to be closer to the Oklahoma border than downtown Dallas. I think the big difference is location with the existing home market relative to the new home market. You're seeing home builders push further and further into the exurbs. With that said, there are some changes to lifestyle. There is more work from home going on that is helping it. Other side is that new homes are just designed better. They're more energy efficient. They tend to be able to use the square footage better. They're using better materials. There are advantages for new homes versus the existing home market as well.
Last year, we wrote a note about the insurance crisis, and it seems that's gotten even more attention lately, as people have gotten these shockingly high home insurance bills. Those bills, along with higher utility bills, the price of housing services, please don't ask me what I paid for my spring landscaping cleanup last year, they all add to these aforementioned affordability problems. How does this resolve? Does it favor certain regions? And do apartments even start to look more attractive to people?
TJ, it's not just you. Carrying costs of homes have definitely moved higher in general. If you look at the largest components of overall housing costs, the non-mortgage component continues to rise. And it's about 50% of the total cost. If you add up utilities, property tax, property insurance, home improvement expenses. That's about 50% of the total cost of a house. For the average homeowner in the US, in 2010, the monthly payment for taxes and insurance was around $350. In 2024, that's up to $630 per month. If you think about regionally where you're seeing the biggest headwinds, Florida, for example, that's where you're seeing the biggest increase in property insurance costs. Texas, it's been property taxes that have moved higher. Across the entire country, home improvement costs are higher. It costs 40% more to replace your roof than it did just 4 years ago. From a regional perspective, where you are seeing a little bit more pressure, it is in the Sun Belt, where there's been the most growth. Where we are seeing it show up, for example, in South Florida, active listings are up really significantly in the last year or so. And we think some of that has to do with just the carrying cost of those houses has moved up pretty significantly.
That's an interesting point about South Florida, because we still read stories about hedge fund managers leaving New York for Miami. But I think the reality is that for those making median incomes, Miami has become very difficult to afford because home prices have been bid up so much, because of insurance costs, because of inflation in Miami. It's moving at a higher rate than it is elsewhere in the U.S. But what about the rest of the Southeast and Sun Belt? Does the story about migration still hold? Or have people started to migrate maybe to even less expensive markets?
Miami is an interesting call out because Miami-Dade County, we know how much it's grown, but it is actually an out-migration market right now. Where you're seeing growth in Florida is in a lot of the more affordable markets in the north part of the state. It's fair that the affordability spread between a lot of the coastal markets, New York and California, and the Sun Belt is actually narrowed because prices in the Sun Belt have moved higher as more people have moved there. Where we're starting to see actually some momentum, and Census Bureau data has shown this, that the Midwest actually has had some really strong housing markets where you're combining both attractive affordability, especially relative to some of the coastal markets, and then you have some diverse and growing job markets. One that we would call out is Columbus, Ohio, is a market where it has very strong positive in-migration and then a very strong housing market where you've seen good home price appreciation.
We've talked about the new home market so far like it's a monolith, but it's definitely not. There's the entry level, there's luxury, there's move up. Which of those are performing best?
Coming out of the global financial crisis, 2012 to 2019, the strongest category within the new home market was the entry-level segment. More recently, we've actually seen the move up and luxury ends of the market start to improve and outperform a little bit. We attribute that to a few things. First is the wealth effect, particularly among boomers. The second is just higher rates and then some favorable demographics. But just to put some stats around this, 33% of all sales so far this year are all cash buyers. They are less sensitive to higher mortgage rates. That would compare to a long-term average that's in the low 20%. Entry level now is just 26% of buyers, which again is below the long-term average of 30% near decade lows. What we're starting to see is the entry level, while still holding up, is underperforming the move up in luxury segments, which are less sensitive to rates and more driven by wealth.
I wanted to address this question of apartment supply. Josh Dennerlein and I have discussed the topic on past podcasts, but there's a lot of supply coming in the Sun Belt, particularly in 24, big deliveries. And in some cities, you're actually seeing declining rents. From what you've seen, has that had any impact on housing market? I know the two are not perfect substitutes by any means, but maybe for some people they are, and maybe on the margin they could have an impact.
Housing is very local, so it depends on the market. But there are a few urban markets in the Southeast, like you mentioned, where there is a lot of supply on the multifamily side that's coming up. Austin is definitely one that stands out. Nashville is another one where if you take all of the apartments in Nashville today, about a third of that amount will be delivered in 2024 in terms of new supply. There is a lot of incremental multifamily supply that's coming onto the market. Where we think it competes with the new home market is more on the entry-level side. And while we're in the process of those apartments being filled, while they're still vacant, we think it could have some impact on the entry-level side of the market. So there is overlap. Broadly speaking, and longer term, if you look at the multifamily market and the single-family market, there is a different potential customer. They're looking for different things. Some of it's single-family, people are later on in their life, they care about school district, different things than the multifamily side. So we don't think it's going to have a long-term impact, but there is some supply that needs to be absorbed near-term.
Thanks, Ray, for joining us today for an excellent discussion of what's going on in housing. For somebody who roots for the underdog, it's good to see the Midwest seeing some strength. Though, let's be clear, I'm not an Ohio State fan.
Great. Thanks for having me, TJ.
The millennial home buying tailwind should continue for another 5 years or so. And that helps to explain why new home sales have been so resilient despite higher rates. Yes, home supply should increase if rates fall, probably a positive for some of Ray's stocks that sell into the remodel segment of the market, but probably a positive for builders too. Home sellers often become buyers, and on top of that, Rafe makes the point that 3 million renters earn $150,000 or more, and the prospect of lower mortgage payments will bring some of them into the market. And it's interesting to see some disparity in regions, driven partly by affordability, with home listings up substantially in South Florida, but particular home price strength in parts of the Midwest. Thanks for joining.
Bank of America and B of A Securities are the marketing names for the global banking businesses and global markets businesses, which includes B of A Global Research of Bank of America Corporation. Lending, derivatives, and other commercial banking activities are performed globally by banking affiliates of Bank of America Corporation, including Bank of America N.A., member FDIC. Securities, trading, research, strategic advisory, and other investment banking and markets activities are performed globally by affiliates of Bank of America Corporation, including in the United States, B of A Securities, Inc., a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC, and in other jurisdictions by locally registered entities. Copyright 2024 Bank of America Corporation. All rights reserved.